part by a grant from Christopher's Fine Jewelry Design, a gallery of imaginative jewelry and gifts in downtown Champaign, offering one-of-a-kind custom design, gemstone round tables, and conflict-free diamonds direct from Canada. Today's programming is made possible in part by a grant from Birkenstock Concepts by Heel to Toe in downtown Urbana, for over 25 years offering all sizes and widths of Birkenstocks, from clogs and sandals to work, dress, and sport shoes. Birkenstock Concepts offers repair and modification services and a certified podorthist and orthotist on staff. Programming on AM 580 is made possible in part by a grant from the Thrifty Nichols American Classifieds, distributed each Thursday in over 100 towns in East Central Illinois, on the web at AmericanClassifieds.com.
Good morning. Welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Producing this program, Harriet Williamson, Travis Stansel, Jason Croft is at the controls. Tomorrow, it's the first Wednesday of the month. That means we'll be talking about food on Focus. Doyle Moore, the man we like to call our chef in residence, will be here. It's always fun when he's here and talk about cooking and exchange recipes. And this time around, he said he thought he'd like to talk about the frittata, which is Italy's answer to the omelet. That's tomorrow. Then in second hour, something a little bit more difficult for you to stretch your mind around. We'll be talking about consciousness and some of the ideas about how it is that consciousness developed. And our guests for the program will be Gerald Edelman. He is a winner of the Nobel Prize for Physiology or Medicine. He's a neuroscientist. He's the chair of the Department of Neurobiology at the Scripps Research Institute and is the author of a book that's recently published titled Wider Than the Sky, The Phenomenal Gift of Consciousness. That is tomorrow. We are here weekday mornings from 10 until noon. We have 10 different topics for you every week, and always welcome your questions and your comments. This morning, in this part of Focus 580, something that we have done occasionally now for fun on the program, and that's to talk about cartooning and a little bit about cartoon history. And our guest, once again, is Bob Harvey. He is a cartoon historian. He's been writing about cartooning for well over a quarter of a century. He's produced published work in nearly all of the cartooning venues, and he's also authored a number of books that look at the history of this art form, including The Art of the Funnies and The Art of the Comic Book, both of them subtitled An Aesthetic History. He's also done a book that looks at the history of newspaper comic strips titled Children of the Yellow Kid. And in addition, has also authored a biography of Milt Caniff, who was the man who created the comic strips Terry and the Pirates and Steve Canyon, and also has a website in which he maintains a continuing kind of conversation and review of things that are new in the world of cartooning, and that is www.rcharvey.com. So if you're interested in the subject and you have internet access, you go take a look at his website. Questions are welcome. Always on the program, people have questions, comments about this art form, and they are certainly welcome. I know that Bob has an, I think we can say, encyclopedic knowledge of the field. We were just joking about how it's a stump the cartoon historian. I said, well, you know, we do that with a lot of shows. We have somebody who knows a lot about a subject, and we invite the callers to try and stump the person. And most of the time, I think we do pretty well. So questions certainly are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Well, thanks for being here.
Again. You're welcome. Thank you very much for having me. I enjoyed it.
Something I thought that was very interesting that I thought we might talk about. Within the past few weeks, I was sort of surprised to see two different comic strips that appear in newspapers all over the country, dealing in a very dramatic and graphic way with the war in Iraq. One where you might expect that to happen, and another where at least I was a little bit surprised. And one was the comic strip Doonesbury, where one of the long-running characters, one of those characters as far as I know, has always been in the strip, BD, the guy who, when they were used to all be in college, was the guy who never took off his football helmet.
Right.
And was in Iraq and was wounded and lost a leg.
Right.
Same.
He also, his helmet disappeared.
And his helmet disappeared, which some people said, as I read about, some people said that shocked them more than anything else.
Yeah.
His helmet disappeared. And that's the kind of thing that maybe you would expect from Gary Trudeau.
Yes, yeah.
Since he obviously has a political viewpoint. But about the same time, a different strip, the strip Get Fuzzy, is drawn by a guy named Darby Conley, virtually the same storyline. A cousin of Rob, the guy who was the guy in the strip, comes home after having lost a leg. And this is from a strip that essentially is a joke a day strip.
Right.
I was very surprised to see such a political statement. And apparently the artist has not commented at all. He has not responded at all to requests for some sort of comment on what it is that he did.
That's right.
But I guess it invites some thinking about how comic strips deal with the real world and something so difficult as the war in Iraq.
Yeah. Well, let me fall back on this alleged encyclopedic knowledge that I have of the subject and first point out that this is National Cartoon Appreciation Week from the 3rd of May to the 9th, and it exists chiefly because the National Cartoonist Society proclaimed it several years ago. And it occurs during the first week in May because that celebrates the first appearance on May 5th in 1895 of The Yellow Kid. Cartoonists, at least since the first part of the 20th century, cartoonists have participated in America's war efforts. The usual way is editorial cartoonists who draw pictures that effectively ridicule or hold up for ridicule the enemy and characterize the enemy as bestial and evil, and alternatively hold up America's leadership for admiration. The political cartoonist has served as a sort of cheerleader. That's changed recently. In fact, political cartoonists in the last couple of years, most political cartoonists in this country are, I suppose you'd say, liberal rather than conservative. And the criticism of the war in Iraq has been almost universal. During the first Gulf War in 1991, many of these cartoonists took the same positions that they take today, and they were roundly criticized. The readers wrote in letters attacking them for their unpatriotic cartoons and so on. But this time, they're not being flooded by letters of protest from their readers, interestingly enough. The comic strip artist has also participated in wartime in one way or another. The earliest that I can think of easily was during World War I, and Bud Fisher, who drew Mutt and Jeff, took Mutt and Jeff over to Europe and put them in uniform, and it wasn't a serious treatment of war by any means. It was just kind of foolishness. Fisher himself got sent to Europe. He first joined the American Expeditionary Force, but found out that he would not be able to continue drawing his comic strip if he did that. So he got out of that, and he joined the British Army and got a job in an information office, which permitted him to continue drawing his comic strip. So he did that. But this was for fun, much like Beetle Bailey is for fun in the Army. In World War II, however, the comic strips had developed a serious adventure story genre, and most of those the leading characters went into the armed forces during World War II. Joe Palooka went in, and of course, Terry and the Pirates, he had been living in China for years. He joined some kind of offshore American flying force. They were called the Fighting Flying Tigers, I think. Mm-hmm. It was akin to that. It was a fictional group in the case of Terry. Most comic characters during World War II had something to do with war. Even Barney Google and Snuffy Smith joined up. Snuffy joined the Army, and Barney went in the Navy. There was a strip called Barney Baxter, which was about a flyer, and it produced one of the most amazing coincidences. Most comic strips are drawn anywhere from 4 to 6 weeks in advance of publication date, which is one of the interesting things about the Get Fuzzy and Doonesbury episodes 2 weeks ago is that both of the strips are drawn separately by cartoonists a long time in advance, so neither one was copying the other, probably. Anyway, in the case of Barney Baxter, In the spring of 1942, Barney and some friends got in their airplanes and flew over Japan and bombed Tokyo. And it turned out they were bombing Tokyo at exactly the same weekend that Jimmy Doolittle was bombing Tokyo. It was a great morale booster. Strategically and tactically, it accomplished virtually nothing, of course. One of the big changes during World War II had to do with the cartoons that Bill Malden was producing for Stars and Stripes. And these were not cheerleading comics. These were single-panel cartoons which usually featured two very scruffy and ragged and soldiers named Willie and Joe. It was life in the trenches. It was real life among the dogface infantry and the sort of attitudes that they had about surviving and getting through the war and trying to get some clean socks and their feet dry and things like that, which was quite different than the normal sort of cheerleading efforts that cartoonists had made up to that time. During the Korean War and the Vietnam War, much of the posture of American cartooning was pretty much the same, well, at least during the Korean War. The anti-war protests in the Vietnam War changed things a little bit, and most cartoonists steered away from the subject. But Doonesbury, Gary Trudeau's treatment of Beattie's leg, was a shock, and it was intended to be a shock. This is a character, Beattie, by the way, appeared in the comic strip before Michael Doonesbury, the title character, did. Both of them appeared in the first day of the publication, but the first panel is devoted to Beattie as a football player. Beattie also went to Vietnam. He's been in the Army or in the Reserves or some official military capacity on and off during the past 30 years. But Trudeau clearly intended people to be shocked by this. We've known Beattie for years. Most of us realize and we're told often enough about the number of American soldiers being killed. We don't hear very often about the number being injured, the number that are sent back here missing arms and legs or having lost their sight. Now, that's a number that's harder to find. And I'm sure that Trudeau, being conscious of that, said, well, we ought to draw attention to the sacrifice that the people who are still living have made. And that's why he did it. In fact, he said, you know, I could have killed Beattie, but I decided not to. I figured I could make a better, more useful statement about war by having him lose a limb.
Yeah. I think it's really interesting that this should have happened. And as you say, that both the artists apparently had this idea completely independent of one another, and it just so happened that they both did it, and they both did it at the same time. I wonder, do you think that Darby Conley is going to do anything more with this, or he feel like he said what he has to say? I'm sure that this is now going to be a continuing. This would be part of the Doonesbury story now, because this is a continuing character.
Well, that's exactly right. Trudeau wants to take Beattie through the rehabilitation process and all of the pain and agony that's associated with that, both physical and mental, and that's one of the reasons that he did it. Darby Conley, on the other hand, has said in the past that he doesn't want to comment on current events, and he deliberately avoids them. He figures there's too much of that going on already. And that he gets annoyed when he reads a comic strip where somebody is expressing an opinion that he doesn't agree with. So he didn't want to get into it. He got into it. And as nearly as I can discover, apart from drawing attention to the fact that we have soldiers returning without limbs, he was also talking about how we try to sneak them into the country without noticing them. And I think that was his big statement. I would be surprised if he does any more about it.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Bob Harvey. He is a cartoon historian. He has authored a number of books about the art of cartooning, both in the comic book form and in the form that appears in newspapers. He has a website where he has continuing dialogue and discussion about the issue. So if you're really interested in cartooning, you can look at that. RCHarvey.com is the site. And then you could head down to the bookstore if you're interested in reading some of his books, including Art of the Funnies and Art of the Comic Book and Aesthetic History, that's the subtitle, both of those. Then if you have comments, questions about the kind of things that appear in the comic pages, you can join the conversation. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. We're talking a little bit about how during the time of Vietnam, cartoonists, well, certainly editorial cartoonists did deal with it, but that other cartoonists didn't deal with it very directly. Am I wrong in remembering that Walt Kelly did, or was he more commenting on American politics, and it wasn't so much about the war, but it was about all of American politics?
Well, Walt Kelly in the comic strip Pogo dealt with American politics more than anything else. He didn't really ever, I don't think, say anything about foreign policy or our engagement in various things abroad, except during the Vietnam War. And then it was very early, and I don't think that his comment, I don't think he was really commenting so much on the Vietnam War as he was expressing a kind of general disillusionment with the world. This was in about 1967, and he drew a long, like a six-month sequence in which Pogo and Albert, and I think Churchy the Turtle, wound up in a place they called Pandemonium, which Pandemonia, which was a kind of prehistoric environment out in kind of a desert place, and there were volcanoes puffing smoke in the distance and creatures that looked like dinosaurs or prehistoric creatures, and there was a human being, the first time in a long time there had ever been a human being in Pogo who was called Noah, and he had a beard and a big nose. You couldn't see his eyes. He had this furry top hat on his head with a clock on the front of it, and he was sort of running this area. Well, it turned out ultimately that what they had done was accidentally blown themselves into the back country of Australia. But for a long time, we didn't know that. There were just these characters there, these strange characters. And there was, in fact, no political comment of the sort that you find in Pogo. My theory is that in 1967, Jack Kennedy had been assassinated, and Kelly was a great fan of Kennedy's, and I think this was disillusioning. But the other thing that happened, and this is my own theory, I haven't been able to confirm it with anybody, but New York's newspaper situation underwent some pretty drastic changes in the mid-60s, and one of the most drastic was that the New York Herald Tribune, which had been combined with two or three other papers over the years, finally went out of business. It went out of the business right about 1967. And Kelly used to frequent a tavern on the west side of New York called Blake's. It was spelled Blikes, and that was not the name of it. The name of it was the Writer and Artist's restaurant or something like that. And that's where he went. And when the Tribune disappeared, I think that place disappeared. And all of these things, and of course the hostilities were growing in Vietnam. And I think Kelly needed a vacation from real life. So he went back to this outback country, and he brought forth animal characters that reminded him of the cartoonist that he had loved as a youth, whose name was T.S. Sullivan, and he drew cartoons for the old Life humor magazine about strange and wonderful-looking animals. And I think Kelly was taking a vacation. Hmm. At the end of this sequence, a centaur shows up who looks like LBJ, and runs around shaking everybody's hands. And then this funny little Buddha character shows up on a huge Chinese dragon. So once again, I think he's at the end of the sequence. He's beginning to get back into contemporary affairs. And the references are to the fear that we had that China was somehow going to become involved in Vietnam.
You know, the other cartoons from this time that I think of as being particularly political, although not because it shows up in the strip, was Al Capp, who seemed to be famously known for public comment about the war and famously known as a hawk and a critic of the anti-war movement. Did any of, and this is the guy who drew the comic strip Le Labner, did any of that ever show up in the strip, or was that just something that he did as a public person outside of his role as the guy who drew the comic strip?
In the strip, he was highly critical of the student protest movement, the student left. Mm-hmm. And one of the people he picked on was Joan Baez, who was a character in the strip. who showed up, who was an extremely unattractive woman whose name was Joni Phoney. I think that was her name. And she was obviously intended as a dig at Joan Baez, who was one of the principal spokespersons for the student left and the anti-war movement. Cap was, it was assumed from all of this that Cap had deserted the liberal side of the political spectrum that he had seemed to represent for so many years and had taken up with the conservatives. Cap denied that, and I believe him. His alleged liberal leanings were not so much sympathy with the left or the liberal element of American politics as they were hostility to the right. Because when he started doing Little Abner, the establishment was conservative, and he was in effect criticizing the existing society, including the establishment. He always said he was after bullies. And when the student left on the campuses of America became the bullies, he went after them.
Hmm. We have some callers. Let's talk with them, starting with Champagne and Line 1. Hello.
Hello. I wanted to ask a question about something you were saying about comic books in the war. There's a book by Michael Chabon, The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay. And in that, the protagonist is a refugee from Europe. He comes to New York, and he's writing comic books. And the hero is fighting against the Nazis. And the narrator tells you that the protagonist felt ambivalent, that this character that he created, well, that the stories glorify the strong man, they glorify war and violent solutions, and that's kind of similar to ideas that the fascists had, really. And I wanted to know what you would, any comments you'd have on that. I enjoy comic books very much myself, but I'm disturbed by that observation. I think that glorification of war and violence in popular culture are a real problem in the United States.
Well, I guess I agree with you. I can't remember that much about the book that you have reference to, but it's quite true that during World War II, the entire comic book industry took on the Japanese and the Germans, and to a lesser extent the Italians. The posture of the superhero industry, Superman and Batman, but more particularly Captain America, was a posture that was patriotic and belligerent with regard to these to the enemies that we had on the battlefield. And to some extent, that was responsible for the huge success that the comic book industry experienced during World War II, because the comic books were being shipped overseas to soldiers. They were easy to read. You could stick them in your pocket if you hadn't finished the story. So it was something that a soldier could carry around with him and give to his friends, and they could trade here and there, and it gave him something to do when they were waiting for something else to happen. And the circulation of comics grew a great deal during that time. After the war, the comic industry lost this adult readership as soldiers went back to civilian life, and the whole industry underwent a kind of substantial change. One of the things that Michael Chabon's book points out is that this superhero phenomenon is related to the Golem, G-O-L-E-M, which is a folk hero in Jewish mythology, which is a super-powered character that was intended to rescue Jewish communities from the persecution and difficulties that they had throughout Europe.
Right.
And to some extent, his superhero character in the book is allied with this Golem character. I don't know. Superheroes have always been, or superheroics have always been, kind of adolescent fantasies, and the comic book industry took that fantasy and capitalized on it during World War II when the country had a common enemy. I don't think that anybody at the time recognized that the superhero notion was akin to the Nazi ideas about the Superman or the Aryan race or any of that. I don't think that anybody was quite aware of that. I suppose some were, but I've not run across it except in Chabon's book. Well, maybe that's enough about that. I'm not sure that I answered your question, but...
Yes. I did just want to add very briefly that I understand that in the Human Torch, he also was fighting against the Nazis, that there were really savagely racist caricatures of the Japanese. And, I mean, of course the war is terrible, but to see them burned alive, that's pretty awful.
Yeah. Well, it was that was another time. We had sensibilities that weren't quite as fine-tuned as they are today. I don't think people thought about that very much, and they didn't. It was just part of the war effort. Remember that during the First World War, we've heard a lot about the internment of Japanese during the Second World War, when they moved all the Japanese they could lay their hands on the West Coast inland, so they couldn't presumably lay the groundwork for a Japanese invasion of the West Coast. Well, during the First World War, they very nearly did that to German Americans, and they were called all kinds of names. And the racial and nationalistic attitudes become very closely allied during a wartime, I think, particularly in the early years in this century through the middle years, before we develop much sensitivity about what the implications of these things were. During World War I, a lot of things, well, one of the most famous instances out of comics is that there was a comic strip called The Cats and Jammer Kids, which had a duplicate called Hans and Fritz, and they changed Hans and Fritz to The Captain and the Kids, the name of it, because Hans and Fritz were German names. You didn't want to have any of that going on. And there was a federal department created by President Wilson to deal with a kind of, it was like a public relations effort to shape the attitudes of the American public toward the enemy.
Okay, thank you.
All right, well, thank you. Let's go to line number two. This is someone in Urbana. Hello.
Hello. I guess I got started in the 50s with Disney crew and all that sort of stuff, but it seemed to me that the superheroes never really appealed to me too much because they were always a little bit too hokey. But I don't know, the thing that happened in the late 60s, early 70s was I discovered underground comic books, and they seemed to talk about war and the violence and the culture and that sort of stuff, but in a different sort of way. They also talked about a lot of verboten things like the sex and the drugs and that as well. But they, one of the main themes that always struck me they had was the innocent group off in nowhere land being marched over by a big mechanized army.
Hmm.
And Richard Corbin came out of that, and he's working with sort of in the heavy metal area, and a couple other folks seem to be floating around. I know a few of them have died off and here and there, but I was kind of wondering if you had any sort of background or knowledge in those, of what's happened with a lot of those people, other than, say, R. Crumb, which almost everybody knows.
Mm-hmm.
Then one other area is the anime, manga type thing. I've really kind of fallen in love with Neon Genesis Evangelion, and I've been told or I've seen hints that they're actually going to make a movie of that, which is something I kind of look forward to as well.
Hmm.
But the underground comic books is the thing that struck me as interesting. I don't see too many parallels other than, say, maybe the zines and some of the more political alternative cartoons, some of them in our local paper and that sort of stuff. Can't think of the names right now, unfortunately. Well, I'm going to hang up and then I'll listen.
Sure. Well, thanks for the call.
One thing I should mention in connection with World War II and the Korean War, during the Korean War, one of the comic book companies, EC, Entertaining Comics, began producing adventure comics. One of them was called Two-Fisted Tales, and the other one was Frontline Combat, both of which were written by a cartoonist named Harvey Kurtzman. And what Kurtzman did in these stories, now this was contemporary with the Korean War, and many of the stories in these comic books were about the Korean War. And what he did that was different was to de-glamorize war. Most comic books up until this time, when they talked about war, they were the cheerleading kind of comic, and the soldier in the field was always victorious, and the enemy was always vicious and animalistic, and the caricatures of the enemy were racial stereotypes of the most crude sort. But what Kurtzman did in these two comic book titles was to de-glamorize war. The enemy was not vicious. The enemy was not caricatured. The enemy was another human being. And it was a signal achievement in comic book writing to produce a whole series of stories with this common theme that war is not a glorious thing at all, and that the consequences of it are bad regardless of which side they fall upon. Kurtzman is often described as an anti-war writer, but he wasn't anti-war. He was anti the cheerleading of war. He was a much more realistic, took a much more realistic attitude about war. I think you mentioned Rick Corbin. Is that he left cartooning and went into the movie industry, designing movie characters and sets and things of that nature. It seems to me that the Alien movies that he was working on them and designed did something about designing those characters. He doesn't do cartooning anymore, as far as I know. The underground cartoonists came into being 1968-69 into the 70s, and there was a lot of anti-war sentiment, I'm sure. But most of the comics at that time, the underground comics, dealt with social issues, sex and alcohol and drugs and so on, rather than war. There were a few titles where the an attitude about war was being expressed. But many of these cartoonists were cartoonists who could not have have gone into commercial comic books. And would not have. They wouldn't subscribe to any kind of mainstream idea. So their comic books, the underground comics, were personal expressions in a way that DC or Marvel or any of the big publishers, none of the big publishers would ever have anything to do with. I'm not very much into manga, to tell you the truth, and I'm puzzled by it. I don't understand what the big attraction is. But I haven't followed it very much, except to know that manga is the name that is given to the comic book presentation of Japanese animated films. And manga in Japan are just huge. I mean, not only are they very, very popular, but the actual physical presence of them is huge. A manga comic book can be as big as a New York phone book. And people read them on commuter trains. They have to spend a lot of time on commuter trains in Japan, apparently. And they read these things there. There's not a lot of written material. It's picture stories to a much greater extent than our comics are. And they've begun showing up on this country, translations of them, in great numbers. And as I say, I'm not sure what the attraction is. But they're here.
That's more along the line of what probably we would call the graphic novel. And as you say, they're enormously popular. They have a lot of adult readers. And Dave Desser was here the other day, who's a cinema studies professor who's really interested in Asian film. And we talked a little bit. Someone raised the question about Japanese animation. And he talked about the fact that that really springs from the comic book. So it sort of starts as a printed form, and then that goes and inspires the animation. Mm-hmm. And he talked about the fact that they're enormously popular, and they're – are particular manga that appeal to different kinds of people. Mm-hmm. And I know you say that it's not something that you really know a lot about. One could spend all of your time just learning everything there was to know just about that.
Yes,
that's a sort of a whole separate field. But I guess I wonder whether you think that there are ways, or have you noticed any ways, when that style of drawing or that style of putting the story on the page pictorially has influenced
American artists. Oh, yeah. And they have taken something from that and incorporated it into their work.
Yeah, there's an awful lot of imitation of the or invoking of the manga style of drawing in American comic books. Many of the traditional characters, Superman and Captain America, and a lot of these traditional characters are being rendered in a style that is inspired by the manga way of doing things. So it's definitely an invasion of a new stylistic way of treating things. And the American, I guess I could say it that, the American interpretation of the manga style or representation of a manga-inspired style, I find very attractive. I don't find attractive the actual manga that come to this country, that were drawn in Japan and have now been translated into American. There, some years ago, they started, well, I don't know, maybe 2 years ago, there's a monthly magazine of manga that's coming out, and they finally got to the point where they could reduce the amount of labor necessary to reproduce or reprint Japanese manga in this country by simply, instead of reconstructing the whole thing, because manga read from the back to the front in Japan, and now you buy this magazine in this country, it's in English, but you start in the back and you turn pages back to the front. That saved a whole lot of time in reconfiguring all these pages and making it suitable for American audiences. One of the things that always puzzled me about manga is the fact that so many of the characters are drawn with round eyes rather than narrow eyes, which you would expect in a culture where most of the population doesn't have round eyes. You know? And the reason for that, I gather, is that the father of Japanese manga, of contemporary manga, was a man who was attempting to do in Japan what Disney was doing here, and he imitated the round-eyed characters that you see in Disney films like Mickey Mouse and Donald Duck, presumably because he thought this was the way that you drew cartoons. And that always reminds me, there's a cartoonist named Don Rosa who draws Donald Duck stories now, and he told me when he was a kid growing up as a very young child, and he would draw cartoons. And he was even then in love with Donald Duck. And if you're familiar with Donald Duck comic books, you know that all the characters are either ducks or else they're other kinds of animals, the most frequent of which is a dog. And a dog is rendered with a black nose, like dogs have, and usually a little floppy ear. And the longer that this went on, the smaller the floppy ear got, until you finally couldn't tell that it was a dog at all. Well, for years, Don said, he used to, when he drew comics of his own, all the characters had black noses because he thought that was how you drew a cartoon. A cartoon, by its very nature, had a black nose. That was what he did with it.
Yeah. Let's talk to somebody else here. Urbana, line one. Hello.
Yeah, hello.
Mm-hmm.
The Boondocks, any comment there? Actually, what I was wondering, certainly a strong anti-Bush, the reaction of the African-Americans to this cartoon, and also what do you think the other audience that it appeals to?
Incidentally, speaking of the Boondocks and manga, somebody told me that it's drawn in a manga style.
Hmm.
And I looked at it and I said, well, I guess so. Maybe it is. I once interviewed Aaron Magruder, and I didn't ask him about that. If I'd known about it then, I would have. One of the audiences for that is the African-American audience. But the other audience is just, the general comics reading, newspaper reading audience everywhere. And Magruder's political attitudes are much more extreme than just about anybody who's come before him. Not even Trudeau, I don't think, has gone as far as Magruder has in expressing approval and disapproval of various elements of our society, some of which are parts of the so-called African-American culture, and some are, mainstream culture that he has objection to. He has a general audience, as far as I can tell, and it's a kind of humor that arises from pure audaciousness. If you're willing to call somebody a name, somebody's going to find that funny. And I think there's a lot of that in the Boondocks.
Mm-hmm. It seems like it's sort of built, too, hasn't it? How long has it been out there?
About 3 or 4, maybe 5 years, I think.
Mm-hmm. I get the feeling that maybe in terms of building an audience, that it's, you know, I'm not sure, but anyway. But I just thought of, because I've certainly, you know, Caucasian, that kind of thing, and taught where maybe half of my students are African American, that kind of thing, and you know, maybe in certain, maybe it's an opportunity for them to, as an outlet, I guess, to a certain degree. I'm not sure.
So, well, that may very well be true, but Magruder is a kind of a equal opportunity insulter. He goes after everybody that he disapproves of,
mm-hmm.
and it's not very often oriented to his own racial background. In fact, the people that he's probably most critical of are the leaders in the black community. And his annual shtick that he does, presenting some notable African-American with the most embarrassing black person award, kind of suggests that. He's been after black entertainment TV for years. He doesn't like Condoleezza Rice at all.
Well, but
and all of these things are not necessarily from an African-American perspective so much as they are an anti-establishment perspective.
But in terms of Condi Rice, my feeling is that there's not a lot of great love for her anyway. you know, I mean, even among the black community.
Hmm.
But anyway, thanks for the comment.
No, thanks. Yeah. Well, you know, the thing that really strikes me about Magruder, though, is that I think in his strips there are also a lot of references to popular culture and youth culture.
Yes.
And it seemed to me that a way that audience breaks down who is the strip for and who is it going to appeal to, it has a lot more to do with how old you are than what your ethnic background is.
I think you're right.
I would think that probably a lot of people— older folks might just say, look at the strip and say, I just don't get it.
Yeah.
Whereas their children or their grandchildren, whether they were black or white or Latino or whatever, they would definitely get it.
Yeah.
And it's about the fact that and reflects the fact that Aaron Magruder himself is a young guy.
Yeah. Yeah. I think there's a good deal to that. He was very disappointed that he did not get a Pulitzer Prize for what he did in the strip after September 11th, 2001, because he had some very pronounced attitudes that were essentially anti-Bush administration's response to 9/11, and got a lot of press out of that, and many papers dropped the strip occasionally, and he thought this was worthy comment. I tend to agree with him. But the Pulitzers didn't go to Aaron Magruder that year. In fact, they didn't, haven't gone anywhere in his direction since either.
Right. Because I'm thinking of that Trudeau also, because of his political content from time to time, papers have made the decision that they would run his strip on the editorial page.
Yeah.
Has anything like that happened with Boondocks?
Not that I know of. Times are changing here. One of the objections that newspaper readers, editors had to the Boondocks thing was, this is supposed to be in the entertainment section. It's a comic strip. It's supposed to be entertainment. Why all this shocking stuff? Mm-hmm. Well, see, the newspaper editors, I think, are by and large much more conservative than the general run of the population is. And we've had edgy social and political commentary in our entertainment for a long time, at least since All in the Family, which started in 1971. And that's been going on in television, and it's been going on, too, on the comics pages. Doonesbury isn't new with this, although it's one of the principal pioneering efforts in that regard. But it's not new now, not anymore.
Yeah. Another call here, line number 2 in Champaign. Hello.
Hello. What is your opinion, or what do you want to say about the James Thurber cartoons? I've personally been very tongue-in-cheek about them, and even including his dogs, he does.
Okay, I missed the name of the strip.
James Thurber?
James Thurber.
Oh. James Thurber was invited to join the National Cartoonist Society when it was formed in 1947, and he declined because he said he couldn't draw and that he wasn't a cartoonist, he was a writer.
Right. But he was a cartoonist.
Well, he was a cartoonist by default, I guess you could say, because he used to draw these little doodles and wad up the paper and throw them in the waste paper basket. Well, he was sharing an office with E.B. White at the time, and White pulled these things out and rescued them and showed them to Harold Ross, who was the editor of The New Yorker, and they right. started publishing them as cartoons. And that's how he got into the cartooning business. He drew some pictures on the wall of a restaurant in New York called Costello's, pictures of his usual women and men and dogs. And when Costello's moved, they cut out these pieces of the wall with Thurber's drawings on them, and they framed them and hung them up in the new place, which was around the corner. That place was eventually sold. It became a, what was it called, Turkey Bay, whatever it was, cafe, and it recently closed. And they have a whole wall full of cartoons in there that they don't know what to do with. But Thurber was, I think most people would regard him as a cartoonist as well as a humorous writer.
Yeah, but, I do. I equal. I mean, I don't separate them because, well, there are whole books of his cartoons.
Well, that's right. There are whole books of what he wrote that's humorous prose, too.
Yes. I mean, I think they're just hand in hand. I think the Thurber cartoons are, well, pretty famous.
Yeah.
I don't know how funny they are sometimes, but there they are, and you know he's the Columbus guy that became quite famous.
Yeah. Well, Gary Trudeau is fond of saying of himself that he was the man that made comics safe for bad drawing. When Doonesbury started back in the 70s, it was drawn in a way that was roughly inspired by Jules Pfeiffer, which was a very casual drawing style. And I suspect that actually it was James Thurber who made cartooning safe for bad drawing.
Well, Steinberg also made some pretty bad drawings in cartoons.
Yeah, I did. I do, too. I agree. And I think he receives a kind of worshipful respect.
I don't know why.
Yeah. Sometimes, yes, I can understand that. But
I've looked at many. And because I'm a fairly regular reader of the New Yorker magazine, and I just, at best, I get a New York.
Well, they printed a page of his stuff recently, and I thought to myself, why are they giving this a page to this kind of doodling, which isn't really funny? It's just sort of an artistic exercise for somebody doodling in his,
right.
as he's watching TV someplace.
Right.
But, you know, that's... people become convinced that this is high art, I suppose.
I don't know. I think part of it is that the mystique. It's New York, and they've already made it their name some other way.
Yeah.
They just go along with it, and it's sort of smart stuff. And I don't know. I don't think Steinberg's material is funny. I think of it more as just decorative. Do it on the wall of the bathroom, the lavatory, the hallway. You know, that's it, just as decoration.
I see.
All right. Yep. Well, thanks.
Goodbye.
We got one more caller here. I want to try to get in Chicago, line 4. Hello.
Hi. Yeah. Hi. I'd like to ask about Dr. Seuss. He was a political cartoonist, I guess, during World War II, and I was just wondering, how did he go from there to children's storybooks, and was it originally, were the children's storybooks originally a political satire?
I don't think they started as political satire, no. Seuss began as a cartoonist, and through the 30s, he did a lot of cartooning for an old humor magazine called Judge, and he wrote little humorous pieces for it also. And he was perhaps most famous for the cartoons he did in connection with promoting the sale of products, advertising cartoons. And the most famous series he did was selling an insecticide called Flit. And there would be a cartoon in which somebody was yelling, "Go get the Flit," and there'd be a big bug. So he had a full career before he published his first children's book, which was To Think That I Saw It on Mulberry Street. That came out in about 1938 or so, which was before his World War II political cartooning career. So he was already kind of dabbling in several different fields, and then he started drawing political cartoons for the New York newspaper called PM. And he did that for 2 or 3 years. Then he was either drafted or enlisted in the military, and he was sent to California where he worked with a unit producing training films. And then after the war, he started doing more children's books. One of the characters that he invented, by the way, is Gerald McBoing-Boing. He wrote a poem about Gerald McBoing-Boing, and then the poem was taken over by the UPA people, and they produced an animated cartoon. The UPA people came out of the same training film unit as Seuss was in California.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thanks. Well, you know, I think we're going to have to wrap it up for this time around. It's always a lot of fun to have you here, Bob.
Well, thank you. We appreciate you
giving us some of your time. Bob Harvey is a cartoon historian. He's authored several books, including The Art of the Funnies, The Art of the Comic Book, Children of the Yellow Kid. That's a book that's about newspaper strips in comic strips in the newspaper, and also done this biography of Milt Caniff, the man who created Terry and the Pirates and Steve Canyon. And if you're interested in the comics, you'd like to keep up on what's going on, you can go to Bob's website, which is www.rcharvey.com. The program today made possible in part by a grant from the Living Yoga Center in downtown Champaign, offering a variety of classes designed to help students bring balance into their lives by finding strength and serenity through the practice of yoga. New introductory classes have already begun, and for more information, you can call 384-5829 or visit their website at www.livingyogacenter.net. The broadcast is also made possible with support from the Corkscrew Wine Emporium, presenting Urbana Uncorked, a special wine tasting event to benefit WILL AM-FM-TV, Saturday, May 15th from 1 to 4 at the Urbana Civic Center. Dozens of wines will be featured along with a silent auction and music by the Baroque artists of Champaign-Urbana. Tickets available at the door or in advance at the Corkscrew. For more information, call 337-7704. And the broadcast is made possible by the U of I Center for Advanced Study, whose Millicom 2004 lecture series presents Carrie Mae Weems, A Reflection on My Work by artist Carrie Mae Weems, Wednesday, May 5th at 4 in the afternoon at the 20th Century Gallery of the Krannert Art Museum. That's at 500 West Peabody Drive in Champaign on the U of I campus. For more information, you can go to their website, which is www.cas.uiuc.edu. Upcoming shows here, I just do want to mention that Carrie Mae Weems will be on our program to talk about her work on Thursday in the 11 o'clock hour. So if you don't get a chance to hear her speak, you can hear her on this program on Thursday. Tomorrow morning, Doe Moore will be here for another program on cooking. We do that the first Wednesday of the month and have for a long time, and always have a good time when he is on the show. And in hour number two, tomorrow we'll be talking with Gerald Edelman. He's a Nobel Prize-winning researcher. He's the winner of the Nobel Prize for Physiology or Medicine. He's a neurobiologist, and we'll be talking about his book, Wider Than the Sky. It is what it is we're learning and have learned and perhaps have yet to learn about consciousness and where it comes from. That'll be tomorrow in the 11 o'clock hour. We're here weekday mornings from 10 to noon, 10 different topics every week. Always welcome your questions, comments. Right now, we hope that you will stay tuned, because up next, it's the Afternoon Magazine with Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. Good morning. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine, we'll talk with Edward Conlon.